Hello and welcome to this July 17th edition of the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm your host, Nipun Chopra. Thanks for joining us. Tonight, Karthik Krishnayar and I are recording a special podcast where we will do a quick preview of the upcoming International Champions Cup, as well as talk about a topic that our listeners often ask us about. That is promotion relegation in the USA. So, Karthik, before we get to that very controversial topic, let's talk about something that's less controversial, which is the International Champions Cup. The games are being played all over the world, but we'll be focusing on the games played here stateside. And it all kicks off, Karthik, with a game between Scottish champion Celtic and English champions Leicester City. And let's start with the framework that Celtic are coming on the back of an embarrassing loss to a semi-pro team out of Gibraltar.
Yes, they lost to Lincoln Red the other day. A team made up of a number of different personalities, right? People who work at the auto mechanics place, people who are police officers, footballers who are working at the grocery store. Right. So it was a tough way.
Would you say it's a team full of character?
Yeah, it's a team full of character, which made an auspicious debut for Brendan Rodgers, certainly. But it can't get any worse. They face, in this kind of Battle of Britain, the English Premier League champion Leicester City, who have lost N'Golo Kante to Chelsea, or appears they have it at the time of this recording.
It's official. Yeah,
it's official. Okay, so they have lost him, but they've made some interesting moves. I think Ahmed Musa, for coming over from CSKA, a player you and I have both seen a lot in the Champions League over the course of the last few seasons, because CSKA's always grouped with either Manchester City or Manchester United, it seems like. He's come over. I think he's a player that gives them a better option off the bench than what they had this past season, when they did win the Premier League, of course, but they had to, when Vardy was out, they had to make a do with Ajoa and Okazaki, two similar strikers, juggle their midfield. Ranieri had to sit Albright and bring Schlupp in to get that pace. I think with Musa, you've got some pace, and you've also got a very strong striker. Damari Gray is, I think, got a great future as a winger and probably will be in the England setup at some point, but I don't think he can play as number nine in the Premier League. And the thinking was maybe he could when they signed him as they were chasing the title in January. But I think now Ranieri and Leicester are sold on him as a winger long-term, a guy that can give them some energy in wide areas and give them some pace. So Musa is a very big signing. Obviously Mendy is also, and Hernandez are also two fairly big signings, but I like what Leicester's done this summer thus far. They're the champions. They're the champions until someone dethrones them. Chances of them repeating are not very good, but I still think they're one of the top teams in English football.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you on all of that. I think Napoli's Mendy is a very good signing, especially it seemed like about 3 weeks ago, Leicester City resigned themselves to the fact that Conte was going to leave. That's N'Golo Conte, not Antonio Conte. And I think they prepared themselves by signing Mendy right away. Mendy's a player that's attracted a lot of attention in Europe. And I think it's a real coup that Leicester signed him, because I know you, Karthik, love yourself some Claudio Makélélé. So I think Mendy, for a long time, even now, is considered the next Makélélé. So it's a huge signing, and I think it's a good replacement for N'Golo Kanté, who we've discussed was pretty much a catalyst for them winning the league. And then Musa, I'm a big fan of Musa also. He scores his goal rate at CSK and for the Nigerian national team is very good. So good signing, absolutely. And I'll be interested to see what happens in this game. So it'll be fun to watch the Celtic-Leicester City game. The game after that is PSG-Inter. PSG, Karthik, obviously, they have a new manager with Blanc being fired after a very confusing set of events, but they themselves have gone through some turnover with the playing personnel as well. They've lost Digne and Ibra, who we'll talk about when we preview the Premier League season with us now playing at Man United. They signed Thomas Meunier, they signed Ben Arfa and Krychowiak from Sevilla. Krychowiak from Sevilla for 34 million. So PSG has had a pretty interesting summer so far in terms of transfers, and knowing them, they're not going to slow down just yet.
No, and I think that there's a certain degree of I don't want to say desperation, but a certain degree of concern about the PSG project because they haven't been able to advance past that quarterfinal stage of the Champions League. So you're seeing a lot of refreshment and retooling right now. I all along thought they had a team that was good enough, not maybe to win the Champions League, but to make it at least to the semifinal stage in one of these past three or four seasons where they've been eliminated at the quarterfinal stage. But they haven't gotten past that. Right. We know Liga doesn't represent much competition for them. So it's all about the Champions League, and they're making these moves looking at what they're going to do in Europe this season coming up.
Yeah, and they were going to play Inter Milan, a team that until the time when Mourinho left, it was a powerhouse. But since Mourinho left, you know, Benitez took over. They had some financial problems and have become also runs kind of in the Serie A. They have had a very productive transfer window so far. They've had a lot of players come in, a lot of players leave on loan, and they've signed some crucial players. But the key signing, Karthik, is a free one, and that's Ever Banega from Sevilla.
Yeah, and I think that that's a very, very good signing for them, obviously. And Banega now has won the Europa League on a couple different occasions. He will be going up in this matchup against his former manager, Unai Emery, who has taken over PSG. It's an awkward time for Inter. I mean, this thing could go one of two directions, right? Inter could just fall into the kind of malaise that that they're local rivals AC Milan are in, and right. Inter has not played well in Serie A the last few seasons, but it doesn't seem like they're in the desperate position that AC Milan is in, or they could climb back up the table and begin to challenge Juventus at the top of the Italian game.
Yeah, we'll talk about AC Milan because, I mean, they have spent a lot of money this summer already, but we'll get to that. In case you're wondering how you get to watch these games, guys, you can watch them on TV, on the website. On the World Soccer Talk website, there's a schedule set up where you can sign up for Sling TV, and which will be showing a lot of these games, and a lot of them will be showed also on TV here in the States. But in case you're wanting to watch these games live, there's only one place you should be looking at in order to get these games, and that's SeatGeek. SeatGeek is always the first place I go to look for games for tickets to a game or a concert. For example, in terms of concert, we have a Coldplay concert here on Wednesday. I'm a big Coldplay fan, so I've been looking at tickets, and I found tickets as cheap as $34, which is ridiculously cheap for a Coldplay concert at Bankers Life Fieldhouse. So I recommend that our listeners download the SeatGeek app on their phone, because I have it on my phone, and I was just looking at it the other day for tickets to these International Champions Cup games as well. And like the games we've mentioned, there are other games we'll talk about, the return of Luis Suarez to play against Liverpool in the LFC Barca game later on at the end of July, early August. So those games as well. And the thing SeatGeek does is that it places all the prices for you to compare by searching multiple ticket sites and ensuring that you get the best deal possible. And SeatGeek does all the work so you save time and money. And SeatGeek wants to help you get the most bang for your buck. So in case you're wondering how you can do this, our listeners get $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. In order to do that, you have to do the following things. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, step one, you download the SeatGeek app. Step two, you go to the settings tab and click add a promo code. Step three, you enter promo code WSTPOD. And step four, SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. So guys, if you want to watch the International Champions Cup, download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code WSTPOD today. Karthik, the next game we'll talk about is the Real Madrid-PSG game. We just talked about PSG, who they've signed. Real Madrid have signed Alvaro Morata, and to be honest, it's not been a lot of ingoings and outgoings at Real Madrid yet, except for that. But we know how Real Madrid function, and I'm sure there will be some high profile signings here in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. you can count on it. I don't know who's going to be sold, if Hamas is going to be sold, if someone else is sold, but
to West Ham of all places. We'll be hearing about Hamas to West Ham, which would be the craziest transfer. Would be the greatest example of the money power of the Premier League if Hamas went to West Ham.
Yeah. I'm just speechless. No, no offense to West Ham. I think it would be great, actually. It'd be great for London. It'd be great for the opening of that Olympic Stadium. I think it would be fantastic for English football, but that's not something that was fathomable too long ago. But then again, I didn't think that we would see some of these other types of signings that we've seen in England. Of the idea last summer of some of the guys signing with clubs they did. I mean, I pointed out
Stoke City.
Seeing Shaqiri sign with Stoke, Kabay sign with Crystal Palace,
right.
And Okazaki sign with Leicester, to me, were all kind of crazy signings. Guys
Iturbe to Bournemouth.
Yeah, right. But guys that you thought would go to better clubs. Now, as it turns out, in the Okazaki to Leicester scenario, that was a great move for Okazaki because he won the Premier League, and he might not have won the Premier League if he had signed with Man United or Man City instead. But I had watched him at Mainz and thought, this is a guy that's going to a top three or four English club, and he signs with Leicester. That's where we are, and, well, Leicester are now a top three or four English club,
right.
Partly because of it. That's where we are in the English game, so maybe West Ham. And they got, obviously, Payet, and we saw how that worked out. But Real Madrid's going to make some signings, no doubt, and we can start just playing fantasy football and pretending we know who those players are. I'm not sure we do. Morata has been re-signed, has been brought back to Real Madrid. Is he just passing through on his way to another club? We don't know. So that's a big question about them. And then perhaps they're going to get a good look at this PSG squad in this game and start rating those players.
Yeah, it'll be a good game either way, because we know there have been flirtations amongst those players for both teams with both of those clubs, with Real Madrid and PSG. So it'll be a fun game to watch. Bayern versus Milan is a game that I'm looking forward to watching, Karthik. Bayern have signed Hummels on a free transfer from rivals. Well, let's just go out on a limb right now and say ex-rivals Dortmund, because the way Dortmund has hemorrhaged players already, I can't see them competing. And the big one coming in is Renato Sanchez, who we've talked about a lot on the Eurocopa podcast. But they have lost Benatia to Juventus, who is a very good defender. Obviously, Hummels is his replacement. And Højbjerg to Southampton, who, of course, didn't really make the grade at Bayern, so the 20-year-old was sold for a good price of 13 million. So Bayern has made some transfers already, and as we keep saying, there will be more ins and outs of that team.
Yeah, and I think what we're going to see is a lot in terms of Carlo Ancelotti putting his stamp on the club and bringing in some more pragmatic players, maybe some players who can play in a midfield diamond. We don't quite know how he's going to set up, but he has liked that diamond in the past when he's had the flexibility to play that. Real Madrid, there was, Real Madrid, he had to figure out a way to get Benzema, Bale, and Ronaldo and James.
Di Maria was the one.
So I guess in reality, well, Di Maria was the one he had that was the star before they decided to sign James, and that kind of messed things up for him, right? Mm-hmm. And they had to sell Di Maria on to Manchester United. So they weren't really able to play in a diamond there, but perhaps at Bayern they will. A thing I'm looking at is Bayern's preseason. You see a lot of, at least in this first game, a lot of young players being bloodletted, including American Julian Green, who scored a goal for Bayern in the first preseason game, and maybe he gets a look. I think more likely he gets loaned out. It's important he gets games. He's stagnated in the U.S. setup, but a number of guys that it'll be interesting to see how they fit in. I also don't know if Pep is going to keep his word and not begin to try and raid Bayern.
Right.
I think Kimmich in particular is a player he'd like to take to Manchester City. I think there's no question about that. Maybe City comes in for Kimmich next year, but I think that's a guy right away. When I look at what Pep has said, the concerns he has about this team he inherits at City, that's a player he molded and played very well, obviously, for Bayern and for Germany this summer, that I think he's going to come after.
Yeah, another player that he's a big fan of is Toni Kroos, but I don't think he's going to get that player from Real Madrid. In terms of other players that I think will be looked at in this summer, well, actually, the big player they're going to be missing, Karthik, is Franck Ribéry still injured? Arjen Robben, we heard, is out for 6 weeks, I think.
Injured again, right, correct.
Injured again. perennially injured, both of them. Milan, let's talk about Milan, Karthik. As you talk about with Ancelotti, actually coached them in one of their most dominant spells, and you talk about that diamond. The best example of that diamond was when Kaká was playing as that attacking midfielder under Ancelotti when they won the Champions League in 07. They've had a huge summer so far, Karthik. I think I haven't checked this, fact checked this, but anecdotally, I think they have spent the most money so far. They've already spent 100 million euros on players. Bacca's come in, Romagnoli's come in. Mihailovic is going to have his work cut out, because when I was looking at the ins and outs, we're talking about, if we take into consideration the players coming back from loan and leaving, we're talking about turnover of an entire squad for the most part here.
Yeah, and I thought they would do this over the course of a couple of windows, and it looks like they're going crazy in this window. Obviously, coming off an another unsatisfactory season last season, but they've made the decision to go out and become very aggressive in terms of the kind of players that they're signing, and I think they want to play a little more of a ball possession approach, more passing, keep the ball in midfield, and that's obviously what they did in going ahead and bringing Montella in to help manage this team.
Absolutely. And the next game we'll talk about, Karthik, is Liverpool Chelsea. With Klopp having a first real window where he can turn over the squad. We've seen him bring in Sadio Mane from Southampton. Joel Matip has signed on a free transfer, and on their way out are Jordan Ibe, who moved to Bournemouth, Martin Skrtel, Kolo Touré, who we knew would be leaving, and Teixeira as well, who just didn't make the cut at Liverpool. So Liverpool also going through that transition, but what I feel like is they're quietly doing some good. While the likes of Man United and Man City are going for the really big transfers, getting the big headlines, Liverpool have done a good job of staying under the radar and making some good, decent, respectable signings here.
Yeah, and you have to also consider what happened this summer in the Euros. International doesn't always translate to club football, but Joe Allen, for me, was one of the 10 best players or so in the entire Euros, along with his compatriot Aaron Ramsey, who I think was probably one of the three or four best players in the Euros. Arsenal now, they've signed Granit Xhaka, at least in theory, to play Ramsey's position. We're not talking about Arsenal, of course, but that's something that Wenger will have to sort out, because Ramsey certainly had a great summer. I think Joe Allen had a great summer, so that's almost maybe in Klopp's mind like a new signing. He's now playing with a lot of confidence. You see what he can do in a deep lying role with another midfielder who's going to go side to side and make the right runs and pick the right passes out, which Liverpool does not have. Liverpool has a lot of guys that they don't have Aaron Ramsey like player. They have a lot of attacking midfield type players that are just that they're guys who are looking to score goals, or they're guys who push forward. They're going to need to sign that player. Now, the guys that they've signed are Sadio Mane, who is an upgrade on what they had, but is a similar style player to an Adam Lallana or to a Roberto Firmino or a Philippe Coutinho. So he's in that vein, just an upgrade, right? It's not really filling a need, but it's an upgrade. Joel Matip is a player I've seen a lot with Schalke. I've seen him a lot in person, including here in Florida against Florida Strikers, and he's a player I like a lot. I think he helps them in central
Is
defense.
he an upgrade on Skrtel?
Well, he's different than Skrtel. I mean, I think he's better with the ball at his feet than Skrtel, and he may not be quite as tenacious as Skrtel, and you need that tenacity in the Premier League. So that might be an issue. Kolo Touré has left. I thought Touré was much better than I expected last season.
Yeah, I agree.
He thought he was very good in the Europa League final. It was the other. I'm blanking out who their other central defender was, but their other central defender had a bad game.
Was it Chan playing there that day, or Lucas playing there that
Yeah,
day?
it was someone else, right? It was someone playing
because
that position.
Sakho was suspended, so it wasn't
right.
Sakho.
And then now I have to mention, I don't want to get Liverpool fans going, but it seems like Sakho was erroneously charged and missed out on the Europa League final, which I think would have made a huge difference considering how that game match went, and then missed out on the Euros and Could he have helped France with Varane injured? I mean, Rami did okay, but I think UEFA might owe that man and the club and the country he represents some sort of compensation. I'm just throwing that out there. Erroneously charged at the worst possible time for both
Yeah.
his club and country.
Another player that should be rewarding compensation to Chelsea. Well, two players, Pato and Falcao, they should be giving their wages back to Chelsea after what they did last season. They are out along with Salah and Kalas from Chelsea. Coming into Chelsea, N'Golo Kanté, as we mentioned, but Batshuayi as well. And Batshuayi had a mixed tournament, but lots of potential with that player.
Yeah, lots of potential with him. Let's see how he acclimates. It seems like every Belgian player had a mixed tournament, and every Belgian player has a lot of potential. I like the idea, by the way. You might not, Nipun, but I'm going to throw this out, and this is a complete sidebar. But I like the idea of Louis van Gaal managing Belgium. I think he can win something with them. It's
Absolutely.
huge
I
upgrade.
agree.
Yeah, huge upgrade on I can't even remember the name, Wilmots.
Wilmots.
Yeah, he was so forgettable as a manager. I'm hoping Belgium can close that deal. There are strong indications that they will go for Van Gaal, and guys like Batshuayi, I think their potential will come out if they play for Van Gaal at the international level instead of the horribly wrong experiment of. I mean, I know when you have great players at the international level, you want to kind of promote them as coaches, which is what Belgium has done with Wilmots. But now it's time. They're about to lose out on their golden generation. They've got one or two more tournaments with this team. It's time to go out and get a real experienced hand, and that's Louis van Gaal. But back to Chelsea. I think Antonio Conte probably wants to bring in another central defender and another central midfielder, and then he can build the team in his mold at Chelsea. We've already seen tactically what he can do with players that aren't as fancied as the guys he's now got at Chelsea, including N'Golo Kanté, who they've signed, who was arguably the best player in the entire Premier League last season with Leicester, the champions. So he's brought in that big time player. He's got still in Willian and a guy like Cesc Fabregas when he's on, guys that can be difference makers in games. He still
Hazard,
has
Hazard,
Hazard, who is hit or
Costa.
miss. He still has Costa, right? So I'm excited to see how Chelsea looks. Maybe it takes a season. It took Conte a season at Juventus to really get rolling, but once they got rolling, they blew Serie A away to the point where I think we began to perceive Serie A as a very weak league because Juventus was so much better than everyone. I think Juve being much better than everyone had something to do with the weakness of the league, and the fall of the two Milan clubs, but also a lot to do with how good a coach Conte is. So I'm excited to see Chelsea. It'll be also interesting to see if he can find a way to use a guy like Van Ginkel, who comes back from loan, Cuadrado, who comes back from loan, and really, I think he would probably like Christensen back from Mönchengladbach, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. But that's a guy I think he would really like, a young player that was ignored by Mourinho.
Yeah, I think Antonio Conte coming to Chelsea, there's a lot of good there's a lot of goodwill about what Conte did, especially with that under-talented, I guess, Italian side. But I think it doesn't bode well for two players. One is John Stones. I don't think John Stones will move to Chelsea anymore under Antonio Conte because and the other I'll tell you the reason. The other player that does not bode well is already at Chelsea, and that's your American defender Matt Miazga, because Conte does not have a good record with young central defenders. He has a great record with central defenders, but he does not have a good record with young central defenders. So I think Miazga is going to go out on loan, and John Stones will probably, from the sound of it, move to Man City now.
Yeah, and it sounds like Pep is really hot to trot to get his hands on John Stones. I'm not quite sure if Guardiola watched last season or if he's just chalking that up to Martinez. But we saw what Guardiola did with Jerome Boateng, who was a player I didn't like very much when he was at Man City. Remember, he was at City before he was at Bayern.
He
That's often
struggled
forgotten.
at City. He
Struggled.
really struggled at City.
And he struggled, I think, really under Heinkens. He was playing out of necessity, but he turned him into one of the best central defenders in the world, Guardiola. So there are these individual data
Same
points.
with same with Gerard Piqué. I mean,
Right.
Piqué,
Yeah.
he did
Yeah.
that
He
with
did with Man United was same as Boateng at Man City, really. Very similar. Great comparison.
And Karthik, let's rattle off the names of these other games, and can you maybe you can pick one of these games that you're looking forward to watching. Barcelona Celtic, Chelsea Real Madrid, Bayern Inter, Liverpool Milan, PSG Leicester, Barcelona Leicester, Real Madrid Bayern, Chelsea AC Milan, Liverpool Barcelona, Celtic Inter. What's a game out of that list that you're looking forward to watching?
Probably Barcelona Leicester.
Yeah.
I think that's the game. I think the most compelling thing about this tournament for us is that Leicester City is in it. Now, Charlie Stilettano made some unfortunate comments about, Manchester United has done more for the game than Leicester, and who wants to see Leicester and that sort of thing, and then had to recant within 24 hours. Just got clobbered in the British
Right.
Bulls, and now has brought Leicester into the tournament. Smart move by Stilettano, by the way, to get Leicester into this tournament. They are an attraction globally right now, and I think that is just a huge game for Leicester City to face Barcelona and to see how they match up, for their supporters to face off against Barcelona, because Leicester is going to be seeded in the Champions League. Remember, the seeding is done differently now. It's not done on UEFA coefficient. It is for pots 2, 3, and 4, but it is not for pot one. Pot one, it's all the champions of the big leagues, the
Right.
top seven leagues, plus the reigning Champions League champion. They will not face Real Madrid or Barcelona or PSG or Bayern in the group stage. So this is a real opportunity for them. They're going to end up facing in the group stage the likes of Atleti, which is no picnic, but Atleti, Borussia Dortmund, Roma. Those are the sorts of teams they're going to see in the Champions League group stage. So they're you could say, well, they're now in Europe, so they'll get to face these sorts of games. They may not get to face Barcelona, so that's a big one. They also play PSG, which will be a lot of fun also.
Yeah, definitely. Two diametrically opposite ways to play football in PSG in terms of how you build a club. And that's a perfect point here, Karthik, to step away from section one. Before I do that, really quick, let me say if you are interested in catching any of those games, make sure you look up SeatGeek. And next week, we will be talking more about transfer rumors. So don't think we forgot about all the other clubs. We'll get to those. We just focused on the ones in the International Champions Cup for now. So we'll be back for section two, where we'll discuss ProRail. We're back with section two of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Before we get into ProRail, Karthik, let's do a quick disclaimer. So, listeners, if you've come into this conversation with an agenda of us against them, or that one answer is indisputably right to any of the questions we'll address, you'll find this conversation rather disappointing. Because, as is true of any complicated issue, the answers tend to be more complicated than any agenda-driven responses to these questions. Both Karthik and I are interested in asking and answering questions rather than furthering an agenda. So now, Karthik, now that we've lost about half of the ProRail crowd, let's begin this conversation. First question is, Karthik, is ProRail required to take US soccer and or US men's national team to the next level?
No.
Why not?
I think there's so much that can be done in terms of player development and infrastructure around the game that does not involve ProRail. Now, would ProRail help? Would ProRail make things easier? Yes. There's
Okay.
no question about
Well,
that.
if it makes it easier, then isn't
But it's
that,
not
yeah.
required. You can
Okay.
still do it without ProRail. I do think ProRail makes it easier. But if you don't have ProRail, you still have an opportunity to put the kind of money into player development at the youth stage with hiring the right coaches and teaching the right techniques that will make this country more successful in this sport than we currently are. And the reality of the situation that a lot of ProRail advocates don't get is they say, well, MLS, and I'm paraphrasing one or two of them here, but MLS is like a Burger King franchise, right? And there's no competition between Burger King franchises. That is nonsense. In fact, I will say this as someone who has worked in NASL and currently serves as a consultant slash hybrid kind of staffer to an NASL team, because I'm more involved than the average consultant would be for the Strikers. There is a lot more predatory behavior and competition within MLS than there is within NASL. And NASL, there's a little bit of this feeling, and maybe it has to do with the structure and where they are, and NASL being a young league and feeling like the system may, the deck may be stacked against them. But there is a feeling of a need of collective good in NASL. All the teams are looking out for other teams, and you don't poach staff members from one team to another. You don't hire another team's coach. You don't hire another team's trainer. You don't hire another team's PR director. In MLS, those rules don't apply. In MLS, I've seen in the last, and I would say 10 years ago, it wasn't like this. The last 5 years, we've seen so much poaching of trainers, of PR staff, of marketing staff, of coaches, and of teams reporting other teams to the league for predatory behavior. Now, part of it is that MLS has two tiers, right? They have a tier of teams that are very much kind of American sports franchises run along the Burger King McDonald's model, as the pro rel advocates put it, and correctly in those cases, teams like New England, teams like DC United, that run like the NFL team in town or the NBA team in town. And then you have teams like Kansas City and Seattle and Orlando that are newer teams that are, well, Kansas City is an original team, but they have had new ownership, right? They had new owners coming a couple of years ago and a massive rebrand and a restructuring of the organization. But Seattle and Orlando that are teams that moved up from the lower divisions were promoted in a sense, but they bought promotion, right? They didn't earn it on the field, although based on the results both teams got in lower divisions, they would have been promoted to MLS if we had it for a rel. And they have pushed the envelope. Orlando naively thinks they're operating like a European club in the U.S., and they make some mistakes because within the MLS structure, there are restrictions on who you can scout, who you can sign, when you can scout people, because you're protecting those New England's and D.C.'s. And Orlando has been reported to the league for poaching and violating those rules on multiple occasions. So I don't think MLS is quite bad and as kind of cookie cutter as the proponents of pro rel on the extreme side of that argument make it out to be. That having been said, there were plenty of MLS teams that need to improve and do run like Burger King franchises.
By the way, I take offense to the Burger King franchise denigration because I love the jalapeno chicken fries. So I'm a big Burger King fan.
Burger King is an example because
they're fans. I know. Kidding. So Karthik, let's talk about the player development thing a little bit more before we get going on some more tangents. The thing that I want to point out is that in the last, maybe, or the second last Eurocopa podcast, you and I talked about Iceland and talked about, you know, the coach, terrific coaching that they have over in Iceland. And a lot of the pro rel proponents rightly point out that the coaching level in MLS and coaching level in American soccer in general is subpar. So I guess the operational question here is, what are the things that we need as American soccer consumers and supporters and people who analyze the game? What do we need to see to convince us that, oh, actually, let me rephrase. What are the things that are required to improve U.S. men's national team, U.S. soccer? One is coaching. What else is required?
Infrastructure, a financial commitment, and a willingness for, and this, and I think the discussion is going to go in this direction, a willingness to break up the pay-to-play cartel that dominates youth soccer in the United States. That is the overriding problem with U.S. soccer. And those who say that it's somehow linked to Major League Soccer and Soccer United marketing and the lack of pro rel are just naive to the history. Now, do I think it would be easier if we didn't have a closed league at the top? Yes. And as I said on the outset, I don't think pro rel is required. I think it would help.
Okay.
But I think ultimately there are some MLS clubs, many MLS clubs, that are kind of bucking the whole pay-to-play system and that entrenched youth soccer oligarchy, if you want to call it that, that's in power, and that really is the power behind Sunil Gulati. I know the Ted Westervelts of the world like to attribute everything Sunil does to being motivated to protect MLS. I think a lot of what he does is motivated to protect those pay-to-play youth soccer clubs who buy into the U.S. Soccer Development Academy structure, and that who also are politically very powerful in each state's youth soccer association. And because they're so politically powerful in each state's youth soccer association, they in fact can control the votes for most USSF elections, more so than Major League Soccer or any professional league. They have more power. They have more money, although that's beginning to change. There are a number of MLS teams that are bucking that by giving scholarships directly to guys who they recruit and they're poaching from pay-to-play youth clubs. So that's and scholarships, meaning they're fully paid, right? MLS teams are not allowed at this point to put anyone in an academy that they charge, which is a good thing. The bad part of this is there's no bad part of that. Let me rephrase. The bad thing is that some MLS clubs have youth teams below the academy level or outside of the academy level where they are also engaging in pay to play. But not every MLS club, but there are some.
Yeah.
But I think pay to play is the be all and end all and breaking that up. And do we break that up by allowing for solidarity payments? Look, I think the U.S. should be involved with solidarity payments. I do not, however, like the idea of a club that has already charged and made thousands of dollars off a kid's parents, then getting $1 million in a transfer fee for that same kid, right? Or whatever percentage they would get under a solidarity payment. So this came up when Danny Ings signed with Liverpool, and I made the point, and I hadn't really thought about it. I don't know who the person on Twitter that responded to me was, and maybe they listened to this podcast, and maybe they should stand up and take some credit here. I basically said, look, Ings is Burnley's going to get X amount of pounds from this tribunal because he trained at Burnley. He was a youth at Burnley. This is what should be happening with DeAndre Yedlin. This is what should have happened with the other players that have been in question, Yedlin being the most prominent one, right? Because Spurs, when they signed him, thought they were sending part of that solidarity payment to Crossfire.
Right.
Now, what in fact has happened, what in fact was then pushed back on me was, well, how much did Burnley charge Danny Ings to be part of their academy, part of their youth club? Their incentive was this guy could be really good and play for the first team, get us promoted to the Premier League, which he did, and then we'll sell him. That's what happened. So without that structure, maybe, you know, they don't deserve solidarity payments if they're basically charging a lot of money for the players already and then want to claim some sort of solidarity payment when the guy goes on to play for an MLS club and gets sold to a European club. So that's something to think about.
So players that are coming through the ranks, well, not the ranks, the American players that are making it tend to, the way we consider them having made is when they move to a European team, you know, in terms of whether it's Bundesliga, it started, didn't start with, but the one prominent figure in that was Landon Donovan, playing both in the Bundesliga as well as at Everton. And then a few goalkeepers before him. But the point I'm trying to make here is that if the operational definition of a player having made it in soccer is playing abroad, then is that a counterpoint to MLS's ability to develop players?
That's a great question, because I think in our minds we think that Jaya Cesardis and Darlington Nagbe, let's take those two examples, they can never be finished products. They can never be finished articles because they've never played soccer really at any level. Obviously, Nagbe was born in Liberia, but those two guys had never played soccer at any level outside the United States. And outside kind of the established system, which was and I have to say, by the established system, the new establishment, which is better than the old establishment, but still needs some work. In Zardes's case, Zardes was the first kind of poor kid brought through the LA Galaxy Academy that made it, that really made it, made it big. And now is a national team regular. And I think is a very good player. I know you're a fan of his as well. The question is, does he have to get to Europe to get better? I tend to still think he does. In Nagbe's case, as a player born in Liberia, his father was a prominent international for the Liberian national team, moved to the United States at a young age, but he played college soccer at Akron. That took a couple of years off of him. Then he came to MLS, didn't have his American citizenship yet, and has played in MLS. He's played his entire career in the United States, as I said, and now he's about to turn 26 and has never played in Europe and might never play in Europe. And we think this is the best American player we've had that can dribble in tight spaces since probably John O'Brien. And that's high praise, right? Maybe that's a bit of hyperbole. Johnny O was, if he hadn't been hurt, might've been the greatest American player ever. Johnny O, of course, left the United States as a teenager and went to Ajax. And that's why we think he was so good. Well, he was so good, but that's part of our thinking as to why he was so good. I don't know that we will ever redefine that thinking. We think guys should be like John O'Brien and go at a young age, or Jovan Karofsky, who didn't turn into the player we thought he'd be, but he went at a young age. Steve Cherundolo went at a young age, became a great player, arguably the greatest club career of any American field player in history, and played his entire career at Hannover in the Bundesliga, and is a legend at that club. We still think in those terms. Can players become finished articles without going to Europe? You know, I think maybe it's a little different in Nagby's case, or in the case of if Jordan Morris stays in Seattle, because it's those two clubs and the pressure at those clubs, or if someone plays for Orlando, the pressure, although Orlando's fans are not necessarily as sophisticated as Portland's or Seattle's. I think maybe it's a little different if guys play for Portland and Seattle. You can replicate the European experience in terms of pressure, competition at those two clubs. Can you replicate that if a guy is playing for the Colorado Rapids, or no offense to these clubs, or DC United or the Houston Dynamo? Probably not. You need those guys to go to Europe.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, because I think in order for them to be the finished product, as you said, they have to be playing against better quality players. In order to do that, the level of MLS has to substantially improve. And how does the level of MLS substantially improve? If you have good players. So it's this circle that, in some ways, it's a circular, you know, in logic problems, we call it a circular argument. But in reality, the problem is that one needs the other thing. And I think over time, MLS arguably has become stronger as a league. I think the influence of more money and influence of bringing in quality player, the designated player thing is probably helping in terms of raising the level of the game, raising the viewership of the game. So those things are good, but I agree with you. I think for now, in order for a player to be considered a top level player, he has to play away from MLS, at least for a considerable portion of his career, or else we don't give him the level of respect as a player that we would give even Dempsey, who to be honest, failed at Spurs. I mean, he did well at Fulham, but he failed at Spurs. So, yeah.
And you don't give the level of respect to guys who come back to MLS at a young age. So
right.
Michael Bradley, it's just a question of what could have been. Landon Donovan, it'll always be that question. I think we think Claudio Reyna, if not for the injuries, would have was the optimum U.S. player. Johnny O, I mentioned. Johnny O played one game in his career in MLS. One game, and that was the last game he played. And got hurt, and that was it. But that's it. I mean, that's the end of kind of how we think. And I think there are two ways to go about this. If our academy structure gets better and you have the ability to break guys in through Major League Soccer, then it's a good place to start. And then you want guys in their peak years in Europe, and then you want them coming back to Major League Soccer at the end of their career so they can extend their career the way Jermaine Jones has. I think Jermaine Jones leaving Schalke and coming to MLS at the time he did was perfect. He's been able to extend his career, and gosh, I mean, Jones is almost 35. It is possible he will be in the next World Cup. He's playing that well. Playing that well in MLS. He's still one of the best players in MLS, and he's played that well for the national team, except when he does stupid things and gets himself suspended, right? But again, Jermaine Jones is a guy who grew up in Germany, right? He came up through Schalke's system.
Right.
He's not a guy who had been dumbed down to the American soccer level ever in his career. There's a reason why at 34 he's more fit than the American-born and raised players, maybe.
Yeah, so I think the point, coming back to our central topic here, I think the point that we don't know yet, because of the fact that the sample size is so small, because the US is one of three systems other than Canada and Australia, I think, that doesn't have ProRel. We don't know if we had ProRel, would these players at this moment be better than the players are at this moment? But I guess the one way to analyze that, Karthik, is let's ask this question. If these players had a ProRel system where they could fail. So they, you know, the team goes under, they're in the second division, they have more, the youth players have more time to develop. That's one way of looking at it. But the other way of looking at it is that American teams, in this American sports fans tend to be obsessed with winning. So I don't know if it's necessarily true that an American soccer player in Division Two will be given nearly enough time to develop.
Yeah,
as
no,
he
I'm
would.
Already seeing this with NASL.
Yeah,
you make a great
exactly.
point. I'm seeing this. NASL has a higher average age per player than MLS or USL. And I when I have conversations with NASL fans, including some of your friends in Indy,
yeah.
they say, "Well, we want to win now. We know we don't want to see
exactly.
our players leave."
Absolutely.
And I've said the second division should be for developing players. That is the that was the big reason I got involved with NASL when mm-hmm. when and the idea of that we could be the kind of the farm team. Not the farm team, but that's the wrong term, right? That gets everyone offended. But the place where players develop and then go to Europe, we're talking mm-hmm. about them going to Europe rather than MLS, and become stars for the U.S. men's national team. NASL clubs, with the exception of the Cosmos and the Railhawks, maybe it's changing now. Indy, you've got an NPSL team. For Lardo, we've got an NPSL team and a U19 team. U19 team that's actually, by the way, going to China, and we'll face Real Madrid's U19 team and Wolfsburg's U19 team in a tournament abroad in the next few weeks, which is kind of exciting for us. But there's been a de-emphasis on player development at the second division level because a lot of the fans say we want to win.
Exactly.
They're hyper competitive with the other teams, and they're kind of in their own bubble, not looking at the fact that, and I just had this conversation off air with a person I broadcast the game with yesterday, Fort Lauderdale Carolina game, that they were remarking that, why is it that all the good young players out of academies are going to USL instead of NASL when NASL is the second division and USL is the third division? And it was there is an interest in winning at the NASL level among the fans to sustain the teams, which is forcing teams to spend, I think, unhealthy amounts of money on players that are recycling within their league. And they're older players. They're 28-year-old guys, 29-year-old guys. We see transfer fees for 31-year-old guys upwards of $1 million, which in U.S. or reportedly upwards of $1 million, close to $1 million, which in U.S. Soccer terms is just ridiculous. And so I think that's the problem. I think that it's difficult in our culture for a team to say, hey, we are developing players. We are a development team. Come see the stars of tomorrow. We're a team that might place a guy on Real Madrid or on Manchester United one of these days. No one's interested in that, it seems. And that's unfortunate. I thought our fans were more sophisticated than that, because I think it's still kind of cool to say, hey, I saw Jeff Cameron when he was in training camp for the Houston Dynamo his rookie season, because I can say that. I went out to Houston and covered them, and there was this guy that they had drafted that was kind of this versatile kind of utility player. I think it's cool to say, I saw that guy, and now he's been a regular in the Premier League for 3 or 4 years. But I guess a lot of American fans don't see it that way.
No, I agree. I see it with Indy 11, the team that I support, because we had our first two seasons, we weren't so good. This year we won the spring championship, and it is big on the back of Coach Hankinson signing a bunch of players who are older than 27, 28 years
old.
It's
on the backs of raiding a couple of other teams in lower division soccer. You have Sacramento, for instance, that's the most notable one. And so, but that's just keeping up with the Joneses. And Hankinson has as good a scouting network as anyone in American soccer, which Indy is learning and the rest of the league is learning painfully. Because a lot of these – that's another thing. A lot of these NASL teams, they don't scout. They just go by word of mouth or who agents bring them, which is why I think Hankinson was able to go beyond that.
Yeah, because he's coached all over the world.
Yeah.
So
I was told very early on by a friend of mine who follows Irish football. I know you and I have had this conversation offline. I'll say it on air and said it on air on a number of other programs which cover NASL, that I was told right away, by God, you know, second division in the U.S., Zayed, he's going to tear it up. Because typically that kind of player doesn't sign in NASL. So I right away tipped Indy as my dark horse before the season just because of that signing. And it's panned out. But that's you don't get players like that normally at the second division level in the U.S.
Yeah, I guess the point is consistent between the two of us, Karthik. It's that it's not necessarily true that if we had ProRel, our teams, our NASL and USL teams, maybe USL more than NASL, but NASL teams would allow for those players to develop the way they are in Championship and Division 1 and Division 2 in England. So just, I guess the conclusion of that question is just having ProRel doesn't fix...
But has it developed as well as people think it is? I mean, the great indictment of the ProRel system is probably how England's national team has developed over the course of the last 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
The great thing you can use as a to promote the ProRail system is Iceland, and I agree with the ProRail proponents that that's a great story, and there was incentive, everything was incentivized. But England is the opposite. Mm-hmm. Because of ProRail, you've got top teams rating the academies of teams where players could actually develop in the Championship and League One level. They're sitting on the bench. We just got through talking about Chelsea and all the guys they've loaned out, and those guys never develop properly. And then England has like a player pool of 35 guys, and they have to take 23 to a major tournament. That's the reality. England doesn't have that many players. The U.S. has a lot more players that can play internationally than England, believe it or not.
And I have to say that the Iceland thing is amazing to me, because I pointed this out multiple times on Twitter and to you offline, that the Iceland model of those players is more similar to MLS, to the American model, than it is traditional ProRail,
right?
Because almost first of all, not one single player on that squad, not one single player on that Iceland national squad plays in Iceland, plays in that ProRail division in Iceland. So the immediate cry from the ProRail people was just hilarious. But the second part of that is a lot of those players came through at academies in nearby countries, whether it was Sweden or wherever it was. And it's similar to the American model, where a lot of these players play in the States till they're 10, 12, 13, 14, hit that promise age, and then they play, they need to come through other academies. So I think Iceland, if anything, is an example of how it can happen without a league that is ProRail. So, Let's move ahead, Karthik, to the next question here, which is a first straightaway question. Is ProRail viable at this very minute? This is the big question.
No,
right? Okay, so then we have to go, why isn't ProRail viable right at this very minute?
Because teams are not sustainable at the second division level. Now, of course, there's the theory that some throw out there, including Ted Westerveld, that the second you take the shackles off, they'll be millions and millions and millions of dollars in the lower division teams. They'll all be flush with cash. I've seen it.
So basically a non-falsifiable hypothesis, which is he's great.
Blackpool and all these clubs in Lancashire, and it all depends on the economic status of the areas. I am sure ProRail will really help the Brooklyn Knights. I am sure it will help whatever lower division team in Los Angeles we're thinking about, or in the Chicago area. Will ProRail help the lower division teams in Oklahoma City or in Wilmington and Charleston, South Carolina? I don't think it will. I think what will happen is what we've seen in England, where you get these clusters of teams clusters of areas where teams in the top division reside. And so what would end up happening is MLS, or the top division, would eventually be made up of teams from New York and Los Angeles and a couple other assorted places around the country. Or Seattle, obviously, Seattle, mm-hmm. Portland, that corridor, Vancouver, if the Canadians were still part of MLS at that point. But that's what would happen. So I think there is a lack of sustainability at the second division level. Teams fold too often. Teams are not managed professionally in a lot of cases. You need in theory, okay, this is great, because now there's this talk that, well, there's this monopoly, all of that. There's Division I, Division II, Division III, it's all semantics in the U.S. Mm. In theory, if NASL or USL were able to attract sponsorships and investments, as we thought we could at the NASL when I started there, we thought we could get these big sponsors and not have to worry about MLS, and we could go into Los Angeles and Chicago and the places you want to be if you want to get a big TV contract, Philadelphia, those sorts of markets, New York, obviously. That there's, in theory, nothing stopping NASL from building that kind of league and building out their infrastructure. But unfortunately, it's just a byproduct, and it's not the fault of anyone in NASL. Mm-hmm. It's the byproduct of the sport in this country and the lack of stability at the second division level. The other thing I would say is, I think you can say it's because of MLS and it being KFC football, whatever, that there are so many American soccer fans who don't follow the domestic game. But I really don't think that's going to change. I think there'll be some interest if we had uptick in interest. If we have ProRail. I don't think the interest will be as low as it is now.
Yeah.
But I think by and large, most of these American soccer fans have hitched on to European football and to international tournaments, mm-hmm. summer tournaments, and that's their thing. And
Yeah,
I don't think that's
let's.
changing. I just don't think that those people are suddenly going to have some sort of great interest in the domestic game, because the reality is, even if you have Pro Rel, the quality of play is not going to improve dramatically. The quality of venue is not going to improve dramatically. And I have to tell you that, just maybe you don't agree with me on this, Nipun, the NASL is becoming a chore to watch. The quality of play is lower than it was a year or two ago. And I think that might be because of overexpansion in the other leagues, MLS and USL, but it's not a compelling enough product for people who to watch. For example, I'll give you this example and leave you on this with my broadcast partner yesterday for the Strikers game, Ken LaVecca. He hasn't called the soccer match before. He's a college basketball announcer, but he knew all the right terminology. He did a great job with the game because he's a sports guy. So he watches the Premier League. He watches the Champions League. He likes soccer. I think he was kind of stunned by the quality of play in the game because he'd probably never watched an NASL game other than to prepare for this. This was his first telecast for us, for the Strikers, prepare for this game. Within 20 minutes, he's saying, gosh, teams are getting both Carolina and Fort Lauderdale are getting desperate, and they're fleeing long balls forward. And because in his mind, he's used to watching a proper match in Europe, Champions League or Premier League, and that's what teams do when they're desperate late in games. Unfortunately, what's happened in the lower divisions in the U.S. and to a certain extent in MLS is that becomes a default tactic 20 minutes into a game. So I had to say to him off air, you know, it's just the quality of this league. It's not the Premier League. It's not what you're used to watching. And unfortunately, attacking players in NASL run out of ideas after 15 minutes. That's just the way it is. That's just the quality of it.
Yeah, well, let's get to the support and the level of football in a bit, but let's go back to what you said at the start, which is teams are not sustainable in the lower leagues. And that's always been my first go-to response to the question, why isn't Pro Rel viable right at this minute? And so I went in to read a little bit more about it in preparation for the podcast, and I was struck by two things. So first of all, there's no doubt that there are unsustainable leagues. Just with I have a bit of an NASL bias because I follow that closely. So just in terms of NASL, we've lost the Scorpions, Atlanta Silverbacks, and I know it's a bit controversial right now, but probably Rayo OKC will go under within the next year or so. So there's definitely some turnover. But in general, Karthik, there has been a steady increase in the number of teams, especially in the last 5 years. Let's look at MLS. From 2011 to 2016, they went from 18 to 20 teams. NASL went from 8 to 12 teams. USL went from 12 to 29 teams. So overall, in 5 years, we have gone from 38 professional teams in the three big divisions to 61 as of today.
You know what? I'm sorry to raise this. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, should we be analyzing this from the lens of, it is true that teams fold, but teams fold in all leagues. Portsmouth pretty much folded. We know Leeds United will fold at some point. Teams do fold. So should we maybe, as a counterpoint to that very obvious response, be cognizant of the fact that teams do fold and might not be because they're entirely unsustainable?
Well, it might also be the league structures in these three leagues, because this could be solved without Pro Rel, although maybe if there was Pro Rel, it would help. As I said, on the surface, I think Pro Rel is a net gain, but it's not the be all and end all. So USL is a league that is, you mentioned they went from 12 teams to 29 teams in a 5-year period. USL is a league that is controlled by a corporation that has no investment in the teams that are in the league. Now think about that for a minute. That's different than NASL and MLS. It is an independent corporation looking to make profits for the independent corporation by selling franchises and charging fees to all these teams. And if a team folds, great, they can sell a franchise in the same market again. I don't know why FIFA allows USL to continue with their current structure. Why they haven't gone in and said, this is an illegal structure. This violates the tenets of the game. The team owners and the teams themselves should have some sort of investment in this league. So that's point one on that. So it lends itself to USL selling franchises all over the place. You know what? The thing that's funny is that Ted, he makes this point about KFC franchises, and he says that that's what MLS is. In reality, that's what USL is. If he made some of his arguments about USL rather than MLS, I completely agree with him. In fact, MLS is a league that the owners do everything. The owners of the teams, now it's funky, single entity, but the owners make the decisions. Garber is simply a mouthpiece. NASL obviously has a team-owned structure. But we went from having 20, let me count, in 2009, we had 11 teams in NAS in D2, USL Pro, and then USL First Division, and 15 in MLS. Okay? We went from that, which was 26 teams in the top two divisions, now to having 32. Now, that included some teams that moved up. So we had Seattle. Well, Seattle just moved up in 2009, but Portland, Vancouver, and Austin at the time, which became Orlando and moved up, and Montreal. So four teams moved up from Division Two to Division One in that period. And we've yet still expanded to some other markets, and there's this proliferation of teams, right? And now these reserve teams and all of that. So the question is that sustainable because of the growth in interest? Let's look at where we were in 2009. The example I give, let's say April 2009, the start of that season, again, 11 teams in Division Two, three of which, four of which became MLS teams, Orlando, or it was Austin at the time, but Orlando, Portland, Vancouver, Montreal, and then 15 teams in MLS, including Seattle, who had just moved up from Division Two. We are now at 32. Now, in 2009, to watch the Premier League, you had to watch it on Setanta Sports, which was a pay channel, a pub channel basically, or on Fox Soccer Channel, which very few people got. MLS had games on at random times, in random places. There was no easy way to watch La Liga or the Bundesliga or Serie A. There was no coverage of no real media covering Division Two, which was USL at the time. There was very limited kind of scope of MLS. SportsCenter, they would make jokes about soccer, right? No other sports editors at newspapers would mock soccer, and the DC United would get hammered by the local paper because, oh, it's okay to spend taxpayer dollars on a baseball stadium because that's a great American game, but who wants to see this MLS team play this DC United, which all the foreigners, they go to that game. I mean, seriously, that was the kind of tone we used to have to deal with. And in as late as 2009, because I think about 2009 and the battle over DC United Stadium, while the Washington Nationals, who had just relocated to town, got a stadium. DC United had been the most successful professional team in the Washington area, in the capital area, and they were being spit on by the local paper, by the Washington Post, and by other media. They're saying, well, it's all these Salvadorian immigrants and people from Africa who've immigrated here, that they're the ones who go to the DC United games. It's not really a community thing. Hidden racism there too. Now in 2016, we got every Premier League game on an NBC network. And NBC has blown it out of the park. We have the Euro final getting over 4 million viewers. We've gotten over 25 million viewers for World Cup finals and for US World Cup games. We have the Bundesliga on Fox. We have games every weekend on over-the-air channels. NBC showing 25 or 30 Premier League games a year on regular NBC. Fox showing 8 Bundesliga games. Fox showing Seattle and Portland as we record this on regular Fox. I mean, just we are in a place we weren't in 2009. So maybe going from 25 teams to 32 teams in the top two divisions is in fact slow growth when you compare it to how many people are interested in the sport. But then you have to then walk back and say, well, is it sustainable? Is this a bubble? Is at some point the amount of scandal around the sport, FIFA scandal, much of which took place here on American soil, is that going to soil the growth of the game? It hasn't yet, but that's a big question.
Yeah, I mean, you make some good points there, but that's actually a good way to analyze it. So if we took USL out of the equation, it would be a very small growth. It'd be 26 to 32 in 5 or 6 years. Actually, that's, now that we talk about it, it's not a bad growth. That's a team a year, pretty much. And that's
right.
Probably a sustainable, you don't want the bubble. We know what happened with NASL 1.0, where they tried to expand that bubble very quickly and it fell apart. So I think that's some response there that's about
now,
right.
Of course, of those D2 teams, four of them I mentioned Orlando, Vancouver, the other two, Montreal and Portland, moved up to MLS. So there was even movement within
Within the, yeah. And
that 2016.
Minnesota United's about to move
Yeah,
to
right.
MLS
And
as
you're
well.
about to move up, right? So that would be five on that
Yeah.
list.
Yeah. So I guess thus unsustainable teams in the leagues, it's not, I guess the way I summarize this part is that it's not as true as I thought, because in the sense that I always just reacted to it in this very guttural way that there's no, those teams are unsustainable, blah, blah, blah. But it's a little more nuanced than that. And I think there is sustainability in the league. But the second part of that sustainability question, Karthik, is the support, which you got into briefly. Teams in both MLS, definitely NASL as well, and USL played often to quarter, half at best filled stadia. There are exceptions to that, like my beloved Indy 11, like Chattanooga FC, like Detroit City FC that are selling out their stadium. So how do we analyze this from the forest level picture here? Is the support of these teams sustainable for a ProRel system?
Well, this is where the ProRel proponents have their argument, right? They'll say, well, it would
Oh,
become
they have their
sustainable.
arguments everywhere, so go.
Right. But they will take that point you just made and turn it on its head and say, well, that's because there's no context in games. And I have to say, I admit that myself. I'm sitting here as the Strikers are preparing for a quarterfinal in the US Open Cup, and we beat Orlando in the last round, big rival MLS team. We're a division below them. We don't get a chance to play teams in the top division, other than in this competition, where we go back to NASL play, and it's like, what's the point? What do you win if you win the NASL? You get a trophy. You guys just won the league. You got a trophy out of it. You didn't get promotion again. I mean, it was cool,
And
right? But
even more so, Karthik, than that, if you're not competing for a league, what exactly are you playing for? So Indy 11 for 2 seasons, we weren't anywhere close to battling for the title. So it was basically a pointless season.
right, so this is where the proponents of ProRel might have a point, is
Absolutely.
that there's no relevance. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going through the motions. I'm a professional, right? I don't want to say I'm going through the motions. I'm going through doing what we do as a professional when we get back to NASL play with the Strikers, assuming, let's say, we lose to Chicago on Wednesday night and we have a game in Minnesota that Saturday. But how can you be interested knowing, okay, we had the one chance, you have one opportunity to make a dent and make a run and get on national television? Well, I mean, NASL's on national television, but get on ESPN level national television, and that's done. Now you go back to a league that if you win it, you get a trophy. That's basically what you get. So it's cool. It's fun within the kind of vacuum that we live in. But so I think that that's where there might be some points for ProRel proponents. Now, the flip side of it that they never talk about is what happens when the MLS team that's getting 25,000 fans a game gets relegated. What's happened to Middlesbrough, though? Now they're back up. But look at check out the crowds, all the ProRel advocates. Check out the crowds at Borough over the course of the period of time they were in the championship. Now, when they went down in 2009, the crowds were still okay at the Riverside. But by 2011, 2012, the place was empty. And it was because they still had a high wage bill, bloated wage bill from the Premier League. That was a couple television contracts ago. So you didn't get the kind of parachute payments you get now when you go down from the Premier League. And so ticket prices remained high. The team wasn't really fighting for promotion. They were struggling in an economically deprived area, and no one was going to the games. Now they've now come back up after 7 seasons out, and they've been promoted. But how many people do you think are going to go to Bolton, who have a fairly new stadium, with them now going down to League One? How many people are going to go to those games? They were already having massive attendance problems after they got relegated from the Premier League at the end of the 11-12 season, and they are now a financial basket case. How many people are going to Fulham games right now? Fulham has expensive ticket prices. They're right in near central London. Now that they're fighting relegation from the championship, this is an issue.
Yeah, I think even more so, Karthik, because a lot of those teams that you mentioned, I think of Leeds United, which actually had great attendance when they first went down, but they've
Leeds
tailed
is kind
off.
of an extreme example because Leeds ticket prices for those who don't know, continue to be in the top 10 in all of England.
Mm-hmm.
They're that expensive.
And Middlesbrough, you point out, when Southampton went down, they had good, pretty good attendance. This we're talking about 7-8 years ago. And Derby County is another example who had good attendance. So there are those teams that are supported. But the difference with American soccer is that those teams are in the blood of those fans. There have been season ticket holders for generations with some of those teams. It's not true for American teams. A lot of these American teams are brand new. They don't have the same identity. They might in 20 years, but right now they don't. So I think it is a serious concern whether those teams will continue to be supported. I can say with maybe it's my bias, I can say that if Indy 11 were to get relegated, we would still sell out half the stadium. Would we sell out the whole stadium? I don't know. And that's a supporter base that I can tell you is very passionate. So when I extrapolate that out to American soccer in general, I do agree with the counterpoint you raise, and I don't think that it is sustainable from the support perspective either. The third perspective, Karthik, is the big one, the elephant in the room, the one that, you know, is the boogeyman for all the ProRail guys, MLS. MLS, the big talking point is it's a franchise system, and we know from, if you are an owner of an MLS team, you obviously don't want ProRail. It makes logical sense. Why would you want to lose all the money you spent bringing in a franchise, buying into this franchise system? So the question then becomes, it makes sense. Anyone would agree that from an MLS owner perspective, ProRail does not make sense. But if you are an MLS promoter, if you're a supporter, if you're a player, do you think that that should be something they should be talking about, as the MLS, should Don Garber be talking about this, or is it off the board?
It's a situation where single entity has created all these legal entanglements that makes it difficult. At the same time, I think MLS has, if they're going to continue to expand and they're going to push towards 32 teams and 36 teams, I think there's a tacit admission that they're going to have to split the league at some point. Mm-hmm. And there's going to have to be some sort of promotion and relegation. The very least they can do is split East and West and have the two leagues not play each other. As it stands now, what's happened is the East and the West teams in MLS only play once a year, and we've had and this is the competitive thing. So the argument for ProRail and the ProRail people can be made by looking at the Eastern Conference of MLS, where teams are racing to the bottom. The football is terrible. The teams are all very mediocre, and they don't have much incentive to get better because everyone around them is mediocre. Mm-hmm. Now, the flip side is the West, where I think you could make the argument even the 9th or 10th plus team in the West. I think Seattle's in last place in the West. They're better than the best team or everyone but the top one or two teams in the East. The West, on the other hand, has been so competitive that teams have not disengaged. What they've done is they kept building and kept competing, and they've rated teams in the East of players, and they've done a better job of scouting Latin America and scouting Europe than the teams in the East. So those teams competitively have become very good, and the Western Conference has become almost like a Division I, with the Eastern Conference almost as a Division II. Maybe at some point you formalize the split. Mm-hmm. If this continues, and this, people say, well, it goes in cycles. I've had that argument made to me, and I agree, these things tend to go in cycles, but the West now has been consistently better than the East in Major League Soccer for several years, and I'm even seeing this spill over into USL, where the Western Conference and USL, with all the reserve teams from the Western Conference MLS teams, is better than the Eastern Conference and USL with all the reserve teams from the Eastern Conference teams, because the Western Conference teams have better academies, they have better scouting, they have better infrastructure, they have better fan support. So maybe that's what ends up happening. MLS is the elephant in the room, but maybe the league splits into East and West, and the West ends up as the first division.
And actually, that's a great point you raise. I wasn't even thinking about West versus East. That's another problem for ProRail, is if NASL is a second division and USL is a third division, and they're spread out with these huge geographical distances that exist in the US, Are they going to have the financial power to sustain a league that is so far spread out? Because a lot of the Pro Rel guys don't understand the logistical problems of running a club. Travel is expensive. It's not a joke.
Travel's the worst, it's the
Yeah.
most prohibitive
You
thing at
and
the
I know of
NASL
an
level.
NASL trade that happened for a player that was on the basis of a hotel stay or something like that. So,
Yeah, and I look, I mean, I took it on the chin because it involved my club, Fort Lauderdale, but it was a good trade for us because we were able to defer the cost of two trips to San Antonio. San Antonio is also one of these airports that is not a hub airport for anyone. They don't really have a lot of low-cost carriers. Southwest flies there, but they don't have Virgin America or JetBlue or Spirit or the other airlines that lower tend to Frontier that tend to lower costs in markets. So it's an expensive trip, and to get two trips paid for to San Antonio for your entire team, that's worth tens of thousands of dollars, and that's a lot of money at the lower division level. Yeah, travel is a big deal, and that's the other thing. As I s said at the outset, the league will be the travel costs of going from coast to coast on a second division budget are very difficult, and I think if you had straight pro rel, there would be a situation where teams would eventually just form in geographic clusters because there's stronger soccer infrastructure support in the New York, New Jersey area, in the Southern California area, and then the Pacific Northwest, and maybe in Florida. So you would have these clusters form, and then Chicago. These clusters form, and then nothing, no first division teams in between them. And that's what's happening in England. Right now, we have a situation where teams in the Midlands keep getting relegated. We went years and years and years without any teams in the East Midlands in the Premier League until Leicester got promoted again and won the title 2 years later. But we've had no clubs in Yorkshire most of the last 10 years, and Hull keeps getting promoted, but Hull's not really Yorkshire. It's kind of on the periphery. We haven't had a club from Sheffield or Leeds or Bradford, the major cities in Yorkshire, in the Premier League in 10 years. That's not acceptable. Yorkshire is the home of football. That is where this sport went from being just kind of a recreational sport to a codified sport, was in Yorkshire, was in Sheffield, and they haven't had a team in the top division in 10 years. We're seeing very few teams now from Lancashire. Not long ago, we had Burnley, Bolton, Blackpool, Blackburn, Wigan, all these Lancashire teams up, and Preston knocking on the door. Now, Burnley is well run, so they keep coming up and down, but the rest of the teams have all fallen by the wayside. If you have economically deprived areas, Birmingham. Now we're down to one team from the Birmingham area, from the West Midlands, which is West Brom. Villa, Wolves, and Brom have all crashed out of the Premier League at the same time as the economy there is weaker than in the rest of the country. So, you can't escape that. That is what will happen in the United States if we have pro rel. You just can't, because I've seen it happen in England.
A good comparison in terms of this, because England is a tiny country and you're seeing the differences there. I think a good comparison to even elaborate further on that point is Russia. If you look at what's going on in the Russian second division, they are having massive problems with sustaining the clubs in that division, and it's because of the distances traveled. So I think the travel cost,
Or
the
Germany. Germany,
Germany,
now Leipzig has come up with the being bankrolled by Red Bull, but for years and years and years now, since Hansa Rostock got relegated and one or two other clubs, we went without a single club from East Germany in Bundesliga One. We went about 7 seasons without one. I mean, that's just crazy when you think about it, that all the clubs in Germany, which is a bigger country than England, were basically clustered in
I think
Bundesliga.
it's only Saint Pauli, I think that was the exception. Is that
No,
correct?
St. Pauli's in Hamburg, so it's in the
So, oh,
West.
that's right. Okay.
Yeah, it's been years and years and years. And I know a lot of people are upset about Leipzig and being a corporate team, but I actually somewhat embrace it because I said, you know what? You look at the map of Germany, half the country isn't represented in their first division. Some representation over there.
And so, Karthik, come back to MLS. So one of the things that you and I, well, you more than I, because I usually just don't respond to people on Twitter, it are the allegations that are made by a lot of pro-rel proponents that a lot of people in the media, and we got a tweet about this today, a lot of people in the media are pro-MLS and anti-pro-rel. So let's take away the extremes right away. I mean, obviously, let's not have a straw man argument. I don't think you are or I am in the MLS pocket. I've watched maybe 10 MLS games my whole life. So let's take away that extreme. And let's also, to be honest, take away the extreme that there isn't an influence. Because at the end of the day, Karthik, MLS is the most popular league. It is being watched in England. Therefore, the articles about MLS are being clicked on more than the ones on NASL, more than the ones on USL. So obviously, as journalists, as reporters, there is a bit of a bias to MLS. Is that fair?
That is very fair. I think there is a bias towards MLS, and I think there are a lot of people. I mean, it's been a struggle to get people to pay attention to the lower divisions. But one of the things I've learned is that we have to have some sort of relevance in the lower divisions, which is why I would like to see NASL teams sign more young players and try and develop more young players. I mean, I think it's going to be great when Haji Wright develops at Schalke and we can say he played for the Cosmos. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be a very good thing. And Carolina has done this. There are a couple of guys that have come through Carolina's. Mike Grella is a great example of U23 team. He then went to Leeds and now is back, came back to the Railhawks for a little bit and now is a big star in MLS at the Red Bulls. But there are that you need to build that relevance. But yes, I think there are a lot of journalists that are very biased towards MLS. And I should point this out. MLS actually gets, it's in terms of market share, gets a higher television rating in the UK. And maybe it's when Sky is placing the games and they're all in prime time and they all involve Lampard or Pirlo or some player they know, Drogba. But they're getting actually a higher market share than they are in the United States. So that is, I guess, something the pro-rel people can point out and say, hey, it's not appealing to our fans here. But back to your point, I think there is a lot of media that doesn't cover the lower divisions fairly, doesn't pay attention. At the same time, I think there's more awareness of it among American soccer journalists. It's been a process. I think there's more awareness of it now today than there has been any time in my lifetime. And I've been following this since MLS really took off. And I think a big part of that, I begrudgingly admit this because I know a lot of these pro-rel people support a certain team, but it is that team. Having the Cosmos in NASL has forced media to pay attention one way or another. Mm-hmm. To whether they want to just write articles to bash the Cosmos, they have to acknowledge NASL exists because the Cosmos name is relevant and the Cosmos draw a lot of attention in the UK and in South America, etc. But yeah, I think there is some media that is not necessarily paid by MLS. I don't buy that straw man argument, but right. I think there's some that are very biased and very defensive. I think that's an important thing. You know, any attack on the quality of play, any attack that Jurgen Klinsmann makes on player development in MLS, any attack made by those who don't really maybe watch the league as closely as these journalists were talking about, they get very defensive and they get they have a particular thing for Britain. I don't know. I mean, they don't seem to have the same sensitivities if a German makes an argument or if someone from Spain makes an argument about MLS. Sure. Someone who's British says something negative about MLS, they get very defensive.
Mm. No, that's fair. And I think that just like with everything, there's truth in the middle. So there is definitely something that we need to do better. I include us in this conversation. I include World Soccer Talk, myself in this conversation to talk about this more. So I think the summary there is that we both agree that the Pro-Rel is not viable at this moment. And we elucidated some reasons. So let's look at the future, Karthik, and we'll end the conversation after this overarching question. What needs to happen for Pro-Rel to be viable? And let's start with 10 years. Is that possible?
10 years is possible, yes. It's possible if you elevate the level of second division, you get some serious sponsors and investment in these NASL clubs, and they build academies. NASL clubs now are having NPSL teams is not having an academy. The Cosmos are doing the right thing. Cosmos are going along the right trajectory. Carolina is going along the right trajectory. Carolina has these huge infrastructure advantages, though, in their market, in the Raleigh-Durham area with Castle and with just all of the local universities there. It's a unique area, so it's difficult to replicate what they've done elsewhere. In fact, they have some advantages MLS teams don't have. I don't think there's quite as many good colleges who play college soccer at a decent level because most colleges don't play college soccer at a decent level. I think they're more in that area than probably anywhere else in the country, a concentration of that. So you need more academies. You need a long-term kind of commitment to doing certain things and meeting certain benchmarks after 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, 8 years. Right now, what we see in NASL and USL is a lot of, okay, we're in survival mode. Our league's in survival mode. Right. Teams are in survival mode. We need to do this. We need to expand here. We need to expand there. And I think at some point you also have to freeze expansion. which unfortunately, I guess, is what sustains these leagues right now.
Right. I was going to say that would kind of work against what we need to get done. So the I guess the big question there, Karthik, is the people we need to convince the most is MLS. Can we convince MLS in 10 years? Say what you predicted will happen. Say they break into two divisions, whether it's East, West, whether it's more diffuse than that. In 10 years, do you see MLS conceding the power and agreeing to to ProRel?
Oh, they'll agree to ProRel if they control it. I mean, if MLS as an entity, there's MLS 1, MLS 2, and MLS 3, they'll take it. I think they might even take it now. The problem is having teams that, well, I mean, look at the Premier League. The teams leave and they go to the Football League when they get relegated. The Premier League, a lot of these problems, it's funny because we talk about ProRel and the ProRel advocates in this country, I hope they realize a lot, and a lot of their arguments are anti-corporate arguments, et cetera. And I sympathize with a lot of those. A lot of the problems in world football or in the club game that they see, that I don't necessarily see on everything, but they see emanate from the Premier League breaking away. And that is their great model of ProRel, right? But the
Right.
Premier League breaking away and being able to keep the money within the Premier League and have this kind of internal close, it's not a closed league in terms of ProRel, but it's a closed league in terms of money. It really kind of has done a lot of damage to the game in England, you could argue. If MLS were able to get their chops on what would be the equivalent of the Football League and League One, Championship, League One, League Two are controlled, or now NASL, USL, PDL, slash NPSL are controlled by MLS. I think they'll go for ProRel. I think they go for it right now. I think the issue is they want control. Their owners want to control. They want to control the revenue, and they won't control the revenue in an open system where they are just kind of a governing body for one of the leagues.
So essentially what we're coming to here is that in order for a ProRel to happen, one, the teams need to be more sustainable in terms of there needs to be more stability. Perhaps expanding teams needs to stop. Number two, we need to have more consistent support. We need to know for sure that maybe in 10 years there will be enough identity for fans with their teams that they would support it would they, if their team got relegated. Number three, MLS would need to first split up into 1-2 and then possibly a merger or some sort of combinatorial system of NASL, USL. And if all of those things happened, we would possibly have ProRel. But the time frame that you give, 10 years, I don't agree with. I think 20 years is
Okay.
probably more realistic. But here's the thing, Karthik. I'm of the opinion that ProRel is inevitable. Do you think that that's true?
Is it in? I think it's likely to happen. I think there's a. I'm not sure if it's inevitable. I'd say there's a 65 to 75% chance it'll happen. So maybe that is inevitable. Maybe I'm thinking inevitable is 100%. But yeah, I think it's more likely to happen than not to happen.
Okay. Yeah, I think we're on the same page with that. So, listener, we would appreciate any feedback you had. Well,
I'm sure there'll be
preferably,
plenty.
yeah, I'm preferably it would be feedback that's so if you have an actual opinion that regarding to these questions that actually wants to enhance the conversation and not stop the conversation, please share it with us. We would love to talk to you more about it in a respectful way. But Karthik, I'm sure we'll talk about this more. And if we get some feedback, maybe next week when we're talking about transfers, we can set aside 10 to 15 minutes to talk about feedback we got. So, like I said, we as a soccer community, you're a journalist, I pretend to be one. We should talk about this more and enhance the conversation. And we'll take more of a lead on that at World Soccer Talk. So, Karthik, now that we've talked about things that will make everything in American soccer explode.
Sweet distant light, and it's just fantasies and rainbows and unicorns.
Unicorns all over the place, Karthik. So, on behalf of everyone at World Soccer Talk, I want to thank our listeners and Karthik.
Enjoy your football.
Hold up. Choosing where to go to university is a big commitment.
By choosing to study at the University of Central Lancashire, you'll be choosing a place that will support you as you step into your future.
You'll be choosing a new place to call home.
We see our students for who they are and who they can be.
We see opportunity.
We see potential.
We see you.
There's still time to apply for a degree through Clearing.
Visit uclan.ac.uk/clearing to find out more.